continue. Someone usually suggests that the city council is against the developer. But is that likely the case? The whole council? The council, being the decision maker, is more like a judge in litigation, in theory an impartial arbiter. Rarely are judges parties in the step one scheme of things. So if you were thinking council versus developer, take another shot at it. Who's against whom here? Stop. Continue. First of all, some person or group is going to be in favor of the variance. Isn't that true of any piece of legislation? Some party is in favor. Otherwise, the legislation would never be proposed and advanced. And someone or group is likely to be opposed to the legislation. So who in this instance is likely to be in favor of the zoning variance? Certainly the person or group seeking to develop the sports entertainment complex and their backers. Anyone else? Put your mind in the practical world of business and community projects. Think, because first and foremost, that's what all professors want to see reflected in the exam response. Thinking. But not just any thinking. Thinking that is focused, that links relevant facts with relevant legal information. Step one begins this process. So who else besides the developer might be in favor of the variance? Stop. Continue. Won't some elected officials likely be in favor of a project that generates tax revenue and might attract suburbanites to the downtown? Wouldn't some business interests welcome the additional traffic? How about homeowners living along the water at the proposed site? Would any of them favor the variance? Stop. Continue. Students generally say no, but what if the developers offer a premium for the property? Some will go for it. All these parties might be in favor of the variance. And having any or all of these pro-variance parties in mind, think, what would be their objective or objectives in gaining a variance? Clearly, to permit development to go forward. Anything else? Perhaps similar developments in other areas are contemplated. Perhaps establishment of a precedent is wanted. And can the parties in favor of the variance offer any support for their position? Are there economic or policy considerations, for example, attracting people back into the city, that the group in favor could point to that would support granting of the variance? Did you come across anything in your assigned readings, anything in a case, any principles or precedents that might support granting of a variance? At this point in the live program, I walk quickly across the front of the room from one side to the other. Now go to the other side of the equation, for that's what you're doing, setting up an equation, and think, who's against the variance? Beyond the obvious, residents whose view or tranquility might be disturbed, who? Possibly an environmental faction might come forward in opposition. Possibly certain existing business interests don't want the competition a sports entertainment complex would present. Possibly there's an anti-growth group. And surely there are elected officials, counting the resident votes, who would support the opposition. And if you think about the objective of those in opposition, block issuance of the variance, can you think of any cases or principles or precedent that might support them in their effort? Perhaps a policy consideration suggests itself. Now focus on the variance itself. Viewed from the perspective of those in favor, does it adequately achieve their objectives? Or would certain changes better achieve those objectives? Viewed from the perspective of those in opposition, what changes in the variance might better accommodate their concerns while yet achieving the objectives of the pro group? Now, do you see? I think you're giving the professor what she wants, a thoughtful, balanced evaluation of the proposed zoning variance, bringing to bear relevant legal considerations drawn from the assigned readings and class discussion. Setting up conflicting pairs and competing objectives establishes a framework for delivering what every professor wants to see. Oh yes, there's really no mystery, as many law students want to believe, respecting what law professors want to see in exam responses. Professors often carp when referring to programs like LEWS. How can they know what I want on my exam? However, given that the purpose of law school is to train lawyers, and law exams test progress in becoming lawyers, at base, there's only one thing a law professor could possibly want to see coming off the page of an exam response. Treatment and handling of the hypothetical, approximating that a competent judge or lawyer, well-versed in the relevant legal doctrine of the course and the particular concerns and interests of that professor, might give. It begins with step one. But the question that should occur to you at this point, as it does to many in the live program, is, wait a minute, is Miller saying, no matter the course, no matter the hypo, no matter the question or instruction, I'm going to be looking for a conflict pairing and party objectives? That's exactly what I'm contending. This is the seminal insight that got me very excited many years ago and made development of Lewes possible. That all legal problem solving presupposes parties in conflict with competing objectives. That the very essence and purpose of a system of laws is conflict resolution. If you think about it, every statute, treaty, rule, or legal precept is the product of a debate for and against its enactment or establishment. Some group or party in favor, some group or party against. Every case you read, every one, involves some entity against another with competing objectives. That's why it came to court. What a system of law seeks, its only purpose, is predictable, orderly resolution of conflict, in accordance with and reaffirming rules, statutes, custom, tradition. If no guiding legal precept exists, if, for example, we're talking about rights of way in outer space or use of the ocean bottom, then we'll draft treaties to anticipate and resolve conflicts that may arise. What the law doesn't want, what is anathema to a system of law, is that conflicts be resolved with fists, guns, or other forms of undisciplined power. I'll go so far as to assert that there's no discussion of a legal nature that occurs in law school that cannot be placed in a framework of competing parties with competing objectives. For example, at some point in law school, you'll likely have a discussion of mens rea. How does one probe the inner workings of the human mind to discover intent? The discussion will sound more like psychology than anything else. Where's the conflict? Well, why discuss intent in a legal context? Because intent is a necessary ingredient if liability is to be found in most civil and criminal actions. So while listening to the discussion of mens rea, you might imagine yourself in a courtroom, at the plaintiff's table, trying to establish intent. How could you use aspects of the discussion to assist your effort? Someone from the same discussion might be at the defense table seeking to show lack of intent or diminished intent. How could that person use aspects of the discussion to assist her effort? The thing you have to understand, what should be said to law students the very first day of class, is that all roads at law lead potentially to a courtroom, which is always an adversarial, a conflict situation. So there will be at least one conflict pairing with competing objectives, always. Some will be more obvious than others, but always at law in a hypothetical, conflict exists or potentially exists. Step one instructs that you begin by seeking conflict pairings relevant to the question or instruction, which is typically at the end of the hypo. Your task is to develop the mindset, which is very much the mindset of the practicing attorney, of seeing conflicting parties and competing objectives in legal situations, including the cases you read, then to think about the legal precepts suggested by the facts that may assist one party or the other in achieving an objective. You'll come to understand them as premises or tools. Okay, step one takes practice if you're going to understand it and be able to implement it quickly and effectively during an exam. So label a scratch sheet of paper torts hypo, or use a blank page in the primer. In an actual exam, you might set aside a blue book for this purpose, or tear a sheet from a blue book if you're limited in how many you can use. Then turn to page 90 of the primer and focus on the instruction at the end of the fact pattern. Stop,